So, Boba, here's my very important question. Matt Moneymaker, Cliff, and Renee are all drowning, and you can only save one. Which one do you save?
That's a tough one.
If he's gonna do them like that, do them all back.
Shut up! I heard a response and he stepped on it.
I guess I gotta think of a man, Cliff.
Yeah, you gotta save Cliff, otherwise there's no podcast, right?
That's exactly it. You got it.
It looked like somebody was bent over and had their head in the window of the deer blind. It either heard me or smelt me, and he pulled his head out of the tent and stood straight up, and that shocked me. They don't make people that big.
The way it moved, almost as if it was gliding across the beach. I've never seen anything move like that in my life. They were screaming at each other in gibberish. It sounded like a language, and they were chuntering away back and forwards, back and forwards, back and forwards. I know what a bear looks like, and there is no way on this planet that what I saw were bears.
Out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6 foot 9. I don't know.
You see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Uh-oh. My name is Jen Cruz from She Squatchers, and you're listening to Sasquatch Chronicles.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Thanks for being here tonight. Got a great show planned for you tonight. Was that easy like a Sunday morning? Man, the guy's underrated. Thanks so much for being here. Got a great show planned for you tonight. We're going to be talking to Bobo from Finding Bigfoot. And if you get a chance, check out their podcast, Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff and Bobo. If you listen to Sasquatch Chronicles, whatever podcast player you listen to, definitely check out Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff and Bobo. The guys do a good job, actually. You know, and I'm not just saying that because Bobo's on the show. It's kind of nice to hear a Bigfoot show that isn't a carbon copy of my show, which I hear is flattering, but it's kind of nice. It's cool to hear those guys talk and interact and some of the different guests that they've had on the show. If you've had an encounter and you'd like to be on the show, shoot me an email. My email address is wes@sasquatchchronicles.com. And if you get a chance, check out sasquatchchronicles.com. You can become a member and get additional shows. Let's jump into it tonight. I want to welcome Bobo to the show. Bobo, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. This is my favorite podcast.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate it. And I know you have a pretty cool podcast yourself called Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff Brockman. And obviously from Finding Bigfoot, everyone knows you from that. Who named you Bobo? Where did you hit the guy in the mouth that gave you that name? Or how did that name come about? I've always wanted to ask you.
Because I had the name Jimbo. And then I had that till I was about 5, and we saw the Dumbo movie. So, of course, my older brother started calling me Jimbo Jumbo, the big fat Dumbo. So I demanded that they drop the name Bo apart and just call me Jim. And so, of course, when you hate the new nickname, Jim Bobo. He started calling me Jim Bobo to double down. And then there was some pro wrestler. He found an old professional wrestling card of Bobo Belinsky. And then so they started calling me Bobo Belinsky. And of course I hated that. And then, so the name just stuck.
Of course it'd come from your brother. That's some cold, right? Cold-blooded stuff, man. No, I'm happy to have you on. I wanted to ask you obviously about the podcast and, the TV show and everything else you have going on in your life. If you would you take me back to a young Bobo? What got you into, I don't want to ask that typical question of what got you into Sasquatch, but prior to finding Bigfoot, where I think most of the audience knows you from, and then obviously your podcast, Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff, prior to all of that, was it an encounter that you thought, you know what, I'm going to spend some time and energy looking into this subject?
No, I grew up in the city. I was a total city boy. My dad had my parents were into the nature and the outdoors. So we'd get out there more than most kids that grew up in town. But yeah, I was a city guy, but I was about five. I saw the PG film on, I don't even know what it was, but I saw it on something. And I was like, and that was right when all the Planet of the Apes TV, like, movies were on TV. So I'd watch those all the time, and I knew those were guys in costumes. And then when I saw the PG film, I just thought that does not look like those guys in the costumes. That looks real. And I just, from a really young age, I mean, since kindergarten, I just started anything I could find on Bigfoot, I'd just devour it. You know, like, there were so few books and stuff like that back then. If a newspaper article came out, I'd clip it out like that, you know, the whole thing. And then In Search of, with Leonard Nimoy and Bionic Man, Bigfoot, all that stuff.
And what was it? Was there a night where you decided, hey, I'm going to go look in the forest? Or was there a day you decided, hey, I'm going to go look in the forest, and then you had an encounter?
No, I looked for, I spent 17 years looking before I had a for sure encounter. I just always had that burning passion to go look for it, you know, and try to see one. And I remember John Green had written, said that if you rode 1,000,000 miles on a bicycle at night, on logging roads in Northern California, within that 1,000,000 miles, you'll definitely have a Bigfoot encounter. Sometimes I thought, well, that's it. I'm going to get myself a bike and go ride 1,000,000 miles on forest roads at night in Northern California until I seen one. Then I got a job logging up in the redwoods up there in Humboldt County. Met a couple guys. Then I met my first witnesses, guys that actually had seen them themselves, and that got the fire burning. Was out looking around, you know, would just go out and didn't know what I was doing. And that's back when I'd hear like a barred owl, be like, what the hell is that? You know, or weird coyote sounds. I never thought I heard a Bigfoot. I just didn't know what I was hearing a lot of the time, or a fox, yeah, or whatever the sound was, you know, because I didn't have a dad, you know, taking me hunting when I was 10 years old, pointing out every sound and explaining what things were. So I learned a lot of stuff from the other guys I was logging with, and then just kind of self-taught, just spending a lot of time in the woods.
Yeah, it is kind of funny to hear some of the different sounds. I remember one time I heard a fox, and it was a sound I'd never heard before. And I thought, Jesus, load that gun. You know what I mean? Like, what's going on out here? And it's a fox. And there's a lot of animals that make very bizarre. I mean, Bigfoot makes bizarre sounds, but some of your natural animals make very bizarre sounds. Tell me about your encounter, your first encounter with it. Kind of what were you doing and what happened?
Well, in hindsight, my first encounters when we were logging up off the Klamath River above the Yurok Reservation. We were on private timberland, and we're on the south side of the Klamath, and we were way up. It was like November, December. We were like 4,200 feet or something like that, and it was snowy and icy. And we're on a north slope. And then we were in the morning. I worked with these gnarly Indian guys, and they wouldn't get out of the rig. We'd usually get out, you know, when it was still a little dark, and start sharpening the saws and hike down into the unit. It was a pretty gnarly hike, get down in there. And then we'd leave our lunches and stuff in the crummy up at the top, and then come back at lunch and get them. And some of our lunches disappeared. And when I get out of the truck in the morning, the Indian guys, these guys were gnarly, like ex-cons and stuff like that. Some of the gnarliest guys in the res. And they were, They wouldn't get out until it got light. They would definitely not hike in the unit until the sun was above the ridge. And I'd get out and I'd hear whistles and knocks sometimes. I thought, oh, it's pot growers up here, you know? And it must be pot growers. You always hear stories about pot growers being out in the woods, like, you know, and sneaking around. So I thought, But then, you know, in hindsight, and those guys never thought that's what it was. They wouldn't tell me what they thought it was, but I heard knocks and whistles, and we had some lunches stolen. It wasn't until years later that I figured out that's what was going on. I'd see those guys like, man, why don't you guys do it? I thought they're just for Bigfoot. Why don't you tell me that was Bigfoot? And they're just like, oh, we're not allowed to tell white guys that. You know, that was like 30 years ago. So things have changed. Like the natives are definitely, that's one of the biggest changes is how open the natives are with sharing the information, which before they would not at all. But is that bird bugging you?
No, that's all right. I want to murder that bird when I listen to Bigfoot and Beyond, so I'm kind of used to it.
I can move the cage.
No, I'm just playing with you, man. I'm just playing with you. No, he's fine. Tell me about your first sighting. I mean, was that in California? I know you're from California.
My first sighting actually followed up. My first for sure encounter, which is still like to me the most impressive thing I've had happen, you know, or the most impactful, even more than seeing it, was my friend John Freitas. He was a law enforcement guy in Northern California, Del Norte County, up there on the Oregon border. And I saw him in the San Francisco Chronicle. Had an article on him, so I'd been in contact with him for over like a year or two, a couple of years. And we were talking. We were going to go out, and the next week we were getting a little expedition organized and do some call blasting with some audio recordings. And I was talking to him, it was when cell phones were real bad connections and stuff. You know, it's like this was May 2001. And it was May 21st, 2001. And I got a call from him. I couldn't hear him that good. It was like real scratchy, cutting out. And he's saying something about a woman, a Yurok woman, having a Bigfoot walk right in front of her across this road, Johnson's Road, up behind Redwood National Park. And I knew this area like the back of my hand. I knew the clearing he was talking about and everything. And I was like, oh, no way. And so I jammed up there. And I found out the next day that he was telling me that it happened that day a year before to the day, like May 21st, 2000 is when it happened. But I didn't hear that part. I just heard that day. So I was like, oh, no way. So I borrowed my buddy's first time I've had a real, I had one of those night owls, like $100 night visions from Big Five. Remember those little junk ones? They were terrible. But anyways, This one was like several $1,000s. It was a Gen 2 Ukrainian model, you know, early 90s model Gen 2 Ukrainian scope. But it was the first time I had a real night vision. I was like, oh, this is awesome. So I went out there and I went to that clearing. Before I blew my vocal cords out, I used to be able to do really loud, really good calls. And I mean, the only guy that fooled Dave Ellis, you know, the guy, the sound from the Olympic Project, Dave Ellis does the sound analysis.
Yeah.
I'm the only guy that fooled him on his spectrograph that matches a Bigfoot call. And so not anymore, but back then I could. Anyways, so I was doing some really loud calls. I was going, man, it's just dead still, quiet, clear. And my calls were ringing all the way down to the river, which was a couple miles away, and echoing for like 20 seconds, just nuts. And I was like, this is awesome, which I'd done tons of times, never had anything happen. Then this time I started hearing a wolf howl to the north. Well, I thought it was one of those like 7/8 wolves, 1/8 husky or Malamute. You know, those were popular back then. And my buddy had one that reminded me of that, hearing this, you know, like just sounded like a wolf, really. And I was going, there's no houses up that way. So, that's weird. It must have got loose. And then after about 10 or 15 minutes, I'll never forget, it just did this like howl into a roar, like just, and every hair in my body stood up, and I just went, no, that's a Bigfoot. Like, just knew it. Like, at the depths of my soul, like it struck a primordial chord with me, you know, and I just got really excited, and I could hear it coming. The road I was on ran north-south. And if someone's looking, if they want to look on Google Earth, you can. It's if you go up 101 to Orrick, California, and then you take Bald Hills Road to the east, it runs up through the middle of the park and runs over to Witchbeck. Halfway up there's a road called Johnson's, which forks to the north. I was on that road. So that thing was coming down from the north of Johnson's Road to me towards the south. And I was a couple miles in off the Bald Hills Road. So I'm sitting there and I'm going, no, I was getting really excited. The thing was getting closer and closer. It took about 40 minutes for it to get down to where I was. And it was getting pretty dark at that point, like twilight. And it came and it went quiet for like 5-10 minutes or something like that. And then I knew it was getting closer. And I just heard this huge roar. You can't impersonate it. It was just this incredibly loud bellowing roar that went into like kind of like a chatter thing, sort of. And instantaneously, I was facing due east, my facing 12 o'clock due east. That was my pretty much exact 9 o'clock where this happened. I had Johnson's Road to my back, and I'm facing east, and the Johnson's was to the west of me. And there was a little tree stand. I was in a little crescent moon shaped meadow, and there's a tree stand in the middle, like kind of in the middle of it. Not a tree stand, a little stand of trees. And so I set my chair up on the east side of that little stand, and I was looking, scanning through this meadow area where the report of the thing had crossed from across the road that year before. So I'm sitting there looking east, and at 9 o'clock, I just hear this bellowing roar, like just out of the blue, just whoa, and then right then it, you know, it breaks a treetop or a thick branch right at the same time, like, you know, it roars and snaps. And then instantly I get to my 2 o'clock, the loudest power knock I've ever heard, just bam, just right there, just crack. So there's for sure two. And they started moving towards each other. They met exactly 12 at my 12 o'clock directly in front of me. They came together, like they marched back and forth. They'd go, they'd meet in the middle, shake the trees, roar, then kind of go back away from each other. Like there were sentries marching back and forth. Like, and they'd meet each time right in front of me, and one wouldn't get to the meeting point before they'd both arrive at the exact same time. They'd time, so they got there together. And this went on for a couple hours, and I was totally antagonizing them, like roaring, beating my chest, throwing sticks out towards them. Like, it's totally stupid, because John told me, like, yeah, if you can antagonize them enough, they'll bluff charge you, but they'll stop in front of you and just roar at you. They won't hurt you, so don't be scared. But they'll make you think they're going to hurt you, but they won't, so don't worry about it. So I was like, all right, I'm just going to antagonize this thing. If it runs up and howls, if it growls, whatever, I'm just going to jump on the ground, like do a little diving roll and try to grab a handful of hair before it kicks me or something. And I mean, I know it sounds super stupid now, but at the time I was thinking, like, oh, so that's my plan. Just try to get close enough to grab some hair before, you know, it does something to me. And I had the night vision. I was looking back and forth. I never saw him. And it had different dials and knobs on the front. And I was messing with those trying to get it to come in. And I guess the battery was fading and I didn't realize that. And so I was messing with the knobs, and I didn't realize one of the knobs was the battery holder. So when I was twisting that, I was getting looser, making the connection worse. And then I twisted it far enough where the battery just was not connected and the whole unit died. And the second that unit died, like instantly, the big one that was on my 9 o'clock position, but it was probably at my 11 at this point, it just roars and then breaks from the tree line charging at me. It was a moonless night. It was it wasn't pitch black. It was dark, but there was starlight. It was clear. And it was just, and then there was, I think three of them rushed me. I think there was three there for sure, too. And they like didn't charge directly at me. They charged into the tree stand to the side of me and or behind me. And I thought they must have kept going because I didn't hear anything. It sounded like horses, like Clydesdales running towards me. And then it just went dead quiet. And I had a big 105-pound pit bull in my truck. And he was like a really cool dog when he was out of the truck, but in the truck, he was a killer. He just guarded it. And I thought, well, I don't know where they went, but they must have just crossed the road, like not by my truck, or he would have went crazy barking. And I was just sitting there kind of going, well, that was crazy. That was the most intense thing of my life. And I started hearing some rustling behind me. And I just thought, oh, it's a wood rat or something like that, you know, something small. And there's a little more rustling. And all of a sudden I started getting this just total body fear, like top to bottom, like all my hair shot up. And right then, within a second or two, the rustling came real close, within 5 feet of me, to my right behind my right hand shoulder. And then way up in the air, I started hearing just, and it just got deeper and louder and deeper and deeper. And then when it got really low, I could feel the rumbling hitting me still, but then that's why I'm convinced they could do some kind of infrasound, because the growl went away, but the vibrations hitting me, it felt like a laser beam hit me between my shoulder blades and neck. And I know that I've had other scientists tell me, well, it was a Bigfoot. It might not have been infrasound. It could be a pheromone they secrete, which causes the same reaction. Like it's ingrained into our system to smell that. It's like a, you know, biological primordial thing. Like it's been ingrained in us. When you smell those things like that, if we evolved next to them, then when you smell that, then it's going to have your mind fill in these things like, okay, it's threatening me. And I just sat there and, oh, we were talking about the woo before. This is one of my woo moments, because I had a disposable camera with a flash on it. Those old cardboard ones, you know, I take like 24 pictures and you drop it off and pick it up next week and you had your photos.
Yeah.
I had one of those. And I was like, okay, I'm going to turn around and snap this thing's picture. And I swear, and I know this could just be my mind playing tricks for me, but I was like, I cranked the thing, you know, so I flicked the, you had to turn on the flash. I turned on the flash, made a little click, and all right, this is, I was totally scared. And I was real nervous. I felt like this is kind of sketchy. And I started to turn real slow. And I just got this loud message in my head. If you take my picture, I'm going to effing kill you and hide your body so no one ever finds it. And like, it just was this loud, clear message. And it could have just been my own imagination filling in from a pheromone scent or who knows what, but that's what I got. And I turned back around at that point. I started getting really scared. Just started shaking. I started in the growl vibrations, even though I couldn't hear it, were super intense and making my eyes water. And I was not breathing right. And it was causing like a real physical reaction. And I got up out of my chair all wobbly. And then I made my way back to my truck. And I had to walk right around the you know, within arm's reach of that stand of trees. And I got around that thing. And I was, you know, like, oh my God, there's a giant, huge ape man that can tear me piece to piece. I think it just threatened me. And then, so I go back to my truck and it's pointed down Johnson's to the north. And I wanted to head back south to get out of there. And I got to my truck and it was dark out. And my pit bull was black. And I'm looking in, and I'm like, oh my God, my dog's gone. I couldn't, and I my stomach just dropped. My heart practically stopped, you know, because I was like, that's my best friend, you know, my dog. And he's gone. Like, they must have came by, and just because I didn't lock the doors, I thought they must have just opened the doors and yanked him out. And I get in the truck and I realize he was down in where your feet go on the passenger side. And he'd torn out underneath the dashboard, like up behind like all the, you know, in the center of your dashboard, like where all your hoses for your heat and air conditioning, all that kind of stuff. He'd ripped most of that stuff out and shoved his head and shoulders up into there. So I figured they must have came to the truck and like scared him half to death. So I drove north on this little, I was looking for a place to turn around. I just had a 2-wheel drive Toyota standard, you know, stick shift. And I just went ripping down the road for 200 yards, something like that. I don't know, maybe 250 yards at the most. And then I saw a place where I could turn around. So I pull in to turn around. I backed in. And when I went to pull forward, it was like a horror movie. My tires spun and I wasn't coming out. I was like kind of stuck. I didn't want to bury my tire. I was like, oh no. So, well, I just drove down here real fast. There's no way those things could have kept up with me. So I jumped out to look. And as I'm looking, I can see, okay, great. Okay, I can get out of this. Then right then, that roar just came back again. That screaming, howling roar just came from above me and to the south where I just come from, but close, like maybe 80 yards up the hill. And then it just started running down the hill at me. And you just hear boom, boom. And just like you hear like a bulldozer going, like that's what it sounded like, a bulldozer on legs going through the woods, just breaking, just charging down at you. And I jumped back in the truck and I took off out of there. I went ripping down the hill. It was about 15 miles back down to the 101. At that time, it's gone now, but there was a redwood mill there. I came flying in there and just, you know, tires squealing, came ripping in, went up to the guard booth and just locked him up and came to a skidding halt. The guy comes out, eyes all big, like, what's going on? Well, dude, there's Bigfoot on top of the hill. Get in my truck. I'm going to show. I need a witness. Come on. You're going up there with me. And he's just like, dude, some big crazy guy comes ripping in here like at 1 a.m. yelling at me to get in his truck to go look at Bigfoot. It's like, no way. And so he wouldn't do it. And I went to the bar down the road, tried to get these guys, and they're old retired logger guys. They just laughed at me, said, we know they're there. We're not going to mess with them. And then I went into town trying to get, I couldn't get anyone to go up there with me. You know, I went to the next bar down in McKinleyville and went to Six Rivers Brewery and the Clam Beach Inn, and I knew people that were there. And I'm like, hey man, like it's the real deal. They're there right now. And they're going nuts. You got to go up there with me. And no one would go. So the next day I went back up there, and man, that was the most scared I ever was. I think I went back up there with a night vision camera, like a Sony night shot with the infrared. And I went back up and put out a bunch of, you know, food offerings and this and that, had infrared Klieg lights set up, lighting up the meadow, which I didn't think was a good idea. But John Freitas, who was his equipment, said, just put these Klieg lights they're red, you know, red spectrum. They won't notice it. And you can film them. And I was like, all right. And went up there and nothing happened. There wasn't a peep. There wasn't no animals there that night. Like no rats, no raccoons, no deer. And it's usually a bunch of stuff going on up there because it borders the park. So there's usually a lot of wildlife and not a thing. But 5 nights later, I came back with John and another lawn guy. And then this guy, Manny, who was my field partner for a while. You might have heard of him, Manny. He was the guy that passed away a few years ago, must have been about 7 years ago now. The guy was spending a whole year out in the Oregon wilderness looking for Bigfoot. He never came to town, but he ended up dying out there in the winter.
I don't think I've heard of him. No.
Oh yeah. He was Manny the Assassin. You know, he was classic, cool guy. But anyways, he was there and I had left a night vision down at my house in town and I'd called my buddy. And he was going surfing up north at Klamath. So I said, hey, just come by, you know, you can just hang out with it. You know, we're just some squatching, you know, and he said, cool. And he came up and brought the night vision up for me. And we were parked in this clear cut about 5 miles north of where I had the encounter. We were parked at the clear cut. It was basically where I thought the sound originated from. And sure enough, we had the thing show up and it was came into the edge of the tree line. We watched it for a while. And then, you know, David Paulides, the missing 411 guy.
Yeah.
He wrote that book, The Hoopa Project, about his first book about Bigfoots on the Indian reservations with all the sketches, drawings.
Yeah.
So there's a foot trail from Hoopa that goes over the mountain because we're in the valley, like about, I don't know, 15 miles inland from the coast or something. 12 miles as the crow flies, maybe something like that. There's an old footpath that goes from Hoopa Valley over to the coast where they trade with the Yuroks, the coastal Yuroks. And you can't cut those trees along the path because it's a historical. It's like a riparian. Basically, they treat it like a class one riparian zone. You can't cut within 25 feet of the trail. And so this is where the thing was popping out. It was popping out into the moonlight a little bit where the old trail was, where it came up and through the clear cut. My buddy and I passed the scope back for like 20, 25 minutes and just watched this giant, huge upright. We couldn't see any detail because, you know, the scope was pretty low quality, but it was just enough to see it wasn't a bear, you know, square brick shape, you know, broad shoulders, coconut head, real thick. We were guessing 4 foot across the shoulders and 3 foot from the front of the chest to the back of the chest, something like that. And yeah, that was my first sighting. So I had my first encounter, then 5 minutes later, my first sighting.
Yeah, that's insane, man. What do you make of, I want to ask you about the mind speak thing. Because for the longest time, I was the biggest skeptic of that. And I remember I had Les Stroud on, you know, Survivor Man on my episode 500. And I was taken aback when he was talking about mind speak. And I was really shocked by it when he was telling me about his encounters. I believe him. I've never experienced that, but I believe what he says happened. And he has nothing to gain by talking about mind speak. And I've had
You have everything to lose.
Yeah, he has everything to lose. And I've had other eyewitnesses on. And I find that sort of thing tends to happen more or less on people's properties, as opposed to like a hunter who stumbles across the Sasquatch in the woods. He's generally not going to tell you anything about mind speak or lights or anything like that. It's generally on people's properties, but when you heard that, was it your voice? Was it someone else's voice that said, if you take a picture of me, I'm gonna kill you?
It was a loud, angry, clear voice in my head. Like I didn't hear like outside. Like I knew it wasn't like an external audio. I knew it was inside my brain or whatever. But like I said, I talked to those Princeton scientists and they were telling me, well, there's pheromones can have that same effect and cause all kinds of basically kind of mild hallucinations. It can cause audio hallucination, or you might see things differently. There could be a biological explanation for it where it's, you know, just pheromone based, but it sure seems like a direct message from one of my proud moments was when I stumped Melder. I said, Jeff, you're a religious guy, right? And he said, yeah, of course. And I said, so do you pray or are you just wasting your time? And he goes, no, I pray. And he goes, so you think you can pray? Do you have to talk out loud for God to hear you? And he goes, no, you can. I said, well, then that means we have the ability to, maybe Bigfoot has the same kind of pickup sensor, you know what I mean, to pick up unspoken messages. You know, if we have the, if, and people say they get messages from God, you know, and they, that's all basically ESP, you know, prayer. If you're doing it non-verbally and you're still communicating, that's basically what it is. So I said, you know, if our brains are set up to send and receive non-spoken messages, then maybe they're just tapping into that wavelength.
Hard to argue with you on that, but then that goes back. Let me ask you, what do you think Sasquatch is? And I know you listen to the show, but well, there's no wrong. I always tell people there's no wrong answer because no one has one in their garage or setting. But what do you think that these things are? What's kind of your opinion?
I totally disagree. There is a wrong and right answer. We just have no idea what it is. But I'm a total fence sitter too, man. Like I hang out with Cliff and Meldrum and like Matt Pruitt. You know, you talk to them guys and it's like, oh my God, you sound like a 15th century, you know, non-science guy to say, well, I think they're a basic hominid. You know, they're in the hominid line. I mean, I think they're, you know, in the Homo branch, whether they're Australopithecus some type. I think that's what they are. I don't think they're like, you know, a paranormal. I think they'll eventually pop up in the DNA and, you know, archaeological record at some point, or if they haven't already. And there could just be weird. They might. I mean, it could just be like a vibrational thing. I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, get into that whole parallel universe. Like how all the natives say they walk in both worlds, the physical world and the spirit world. And which would account for a lot. I mean, if you go with that, it you can sum up basically all the Bigfoot phenomena. You can explain that way pretty easily. But if you just go with it and like, well, it's just an ape or like a relic hominid, then you get into the whole thing about, well, then how come we don't have more evidence? You know, like, why isn't there? There should be some kind of. I mean, you've had stories on your show about people getting bodies. We've talked to people that have definitely that I believe that have shot and killed them and come up and looked at them, you know, and freaked out and left it or whatever they did with it, you know, or didn't do with it, just left it there. But it just, you'd think we'd have more solid evidence, you know, more physical evidence and photographic for that matter, especially photographic evidence. If they were just a regular species, like, you know, a wood ape, you know, you think they'd show up more.
Yeah, well, let me ask you a couple of questions. What do you make of, I know you mentioned wood ape and everything like that. You know, one of the things a lot of Bigfoot researchers say, which is a tired argument that they make, I understand why they make it, but when they say, why don't we have more bodies? We should have found a body by now. And the answer you're going to get from every Bigfoot researcher on the planet, I can tell you word for word what they're going to say is, well, how many times do you find a bear out in the woods? I'm with you on that argument to a certain point. And when you get down to like Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, you're out there in California, Bobo, you know, when you start to get down Southern California, not a lot of woods to run around in, but you guys got the Zubies, you got all kinds of weird accounts down there. And my point is, that makes no sense then. I understand the forest eats a body, for example. You know, you shoot a deer, you come back a week later, you're probably right. It's probably not going to be there in the Pacific Northwest, but what about Arizona? What about Nevada? What about New Mexico? So when you start, do you pass those encounters off or what do you make of them being in those type of climates? You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. They're in those climates a lot more than people realize. I just got a video a couple of weeks ago from a Border Patrol agent that had taken a few years back of an 8-9 footer. I mean, it's not nothing great, but I mean, I know they're out there. I was really surprised to find out where they'll go. But when you look back at a lot of those sightings in those areas, it seems especially odd. A lot of them are like in a specific time frame. And when you go back and look at the meteorological records or talk to locals about what was going on at that time, there might have been like an excessive amount of rainfall in places that were normally dry or wet for, you know, several months and all kinds of plants bloomed and this and that. And then other animals, not just Bigfoots, but other animals are seen in these areas where they're not normally seen. that accounts for some of it. And then other parts of it is that I think they're just highly adaptable. And they, I mean, I know they're still in East San Diego. I've been down there. I've talked to the tribes, and they're actually was real close to getting to go into this cave where they know they lived. And they're still there, like Moneymaker. That's where Moneymaker does his stuff now, is down in northern San Diego, northeast San Diego. And I've talked to really good eyewitnesses down there, so I know they're there. I think they're just highly adaptable. I mean, they'd rather be in the, I think they'd rather be, you know, in the thick forest, but they don't need a whole lot of cover to operate, you know. And there's more food in a lot of those places than people realize. So it doesn't, I mean, it shocked me at first, but I've heard so many stories from these seemingly odd locations. I believe people when they tell me that they seem out in those places for the most part.
Can I ask you, have you ever seen the lights?
Yeah. My first encounter with the lights was we're up near these Indian burial grounds up past Bluff Creek. I was with Cliff and Yams and Bob Strain. Bob's part of the Wood Ape Conservancy out in the, he's part of the Area X project, whatever Area X project. This was, I think it was in 2007, I think. Anyways, we were out there, and Cliff and I were out there first for a week by ourselves. And we had some good action, like a lot of knocks, and we had a scream right on the edge of our camp, like right on the edge, I mean, like 50 feet away when we went to bed one night. It was right when the audio, it was a little mini CD recorder, whatever, or mini, those mini recorders had like a 74-minute mini disc you put in there to record.
Oh, yeah, the little tiny ones.
Yeah, so we had that out. And so as soon as that thing clicked off, the thing screamed. Like right seconds after it turned off, it screamed full blast at us. And then the next day, a couple nights later, we were sitting there and we started hearing like something breaking branches. Like it sounded like a big squash coming through the woods kind of towards our camp. And I was like, no way. And there's a lot of bushes around there. And I could just barely see over the bushes. And Cliff was too short. But I start seeing this blue light coming out of the woods, and I'm like, what is that? And then I see, like, and Cliff has the audio actually, but no video, but the audio of me talking, and we were talking together and me describing what I'm saying. I'm like, what is that, a plane? Is that a, what is that? Is that? And then I see the ball of light, and it's way too big to be a plane or anything like that. I'm like, I'm looking through the trees, but it should be not a sky backdrop. I should be looking at the mountain, like not like the mountain goes up right there, like, you know, just 100 yards away. I shouldn't be seeing, like, you know, your brain can't process a lot of times things that are happening like that. Like you're trying to figure out what you know already. Then I see this blue ball of light, and I see it pass in front of us. Like it was real soft light. Like it wasn't like lighting up like a big area. Like it had to be within, I'd say 3 to 5 feet of a tree for it to light the tree up, something like that. And I just watched it flip the trees, but where it was floating was, you know, cracking and branches breaking, but all I could see was a blue ball of light.
Yeah, that's bizarre. That's really bizarre. What do you make of the lights? But what was kind of your opinion? Because, you know, a lot of eyewitnesses, it's odd to me. It's what Dr. Brenner Nagel would call strange coincidences when, I'm not saying Sasquatch and lights are directly related, but it sure seems weird. It's a weird coincidence, as he would put it, that they're around. What do you think that the lights are?
Well, the day after that, we had that sighting, there was this famous old native guy, medicine man named Charlie Tom from the Karuk tribe. They call him the last wild Indian. He was born back in like the late 20s. And he was out where you turn up the Gill Road that goes up to Bluff Creek. There's a town, Orleans, at the base of the hill. And it was a big mining center for that area back then. And his mom, and I guess his dad was killed, and his mom was attacked, like raped or something, and by the miners. And his great grandpa and grandma took him and ran up in where the graveyards were. Like there were no roads up there at that point, because they didn't even get halfway up there until 58, when they put in the road with Jerry Crew and all that, when they found the first Bigfoot tracks they cast. So I mean, it was way out there. I mean, and there was no roads out there back then. So he lived out there until he was 12 before I think his grandparents or whatever died. So he came into town finally, but he'd grown up Stone Age, and he had the strongest medicine of anyone. And he had when he was 5 or 6 years old, he gathered his first Bigfoot hairs. He watched a huge, he said the biggest one he ever saw, scratching his back on a pine tree and then walk away. And he went up and gathered some of the hairs, and he used that. And that's where he got his medicine from. And he, and over the years, he collected from Bigfoot nests, other Bigfoot hairs, and he wadded them up in a big ball, and that's where he got his power. But when they, you know, that, I don't know how much you know about the Native American stuff, but they put in that huge on the mall in Washington, D.C. The biggest building is the Native American Museum back there. When they dedicated it back in 2004, it's the biggest building on the mall back there. And when they did it, they had like all whatever 504 recognized tribes in North America, whatever. They had a medicine man and like a chief or whatever, you know, representative for each tribe. And then the medicine, they divided the tribes up into north, south, east, west. And each section elected their own. The medicine men in that section all elected one, you know, basically. So they were like all priests voting, you know, for, and they'd have a bishop or cardinal, whatever, represent them. And then, so those four directional leaders came together, and then those four decided who was going to be the head guy for doing the incantations and all that. And those other four agreed on Charlie Tom. So out of all the Native American medicine men, they agreed Charlie Tom was the guy. So, I mean, he's the man, you know, when it comes to that traditional Native stuff. And so we ran into him the next day. I'm like, hey, what's up, Charlie Tom? And he's like, hey, what's going on? And he's classic. He's trying to be a stand-up. He's like 85 years old at this time, and he's trying to be a stand-up comedian. He's just a classic dude. And so we start talking to him, and Bob and Strain and Yam show up, and we're BSing with him, you know, and he sang us the traditional Bigfoot song, and Bob's actually got a recording of it. We're going to play it on our show here coming up pretty soon. Anyways, he did his call, and we said, he was talking about calling in Bigfoot. We said, well, can you call him in? So he just sang that song. We said, well, you know, can you call for him? So he yelled out, my animal friends come, you know, he called out to him, and this is, I got multiple witnesses. He did that. This red-tailed hawk starts screaming up above us, flies down and lands on the branch as close as it could get to Charlie Tom's head, and just looks at Charlie Tom and squawks a couple of times. Then a rabbit hops out from the brush and hops right up to Charlie Tom. Then another rabbit comes out and goes right up to Charlie Tom. Then a little finch flies down, lands on his shoulder. And all of a sudden we're like going, no way, this all happened in like less than 5 minutes, like 2-3 minutes. And then we start hearing heavy walking sound coming down towards us, and it's deer season, like, you know, it's hunters, and we're in a hunting camp, really. Hunters utilize this spot fairly often. We're like, and we're all looking at each other going, oh my god, there's a Bigfoot coming down the hill at us, right? Because you're just coming down the hill right towards us in broad daylight, like it's 10 in the morning, and we're all looking at each other. Then it was a little herd of deer, and they come out across the creek and stand next to Charlie Tom, and he's petting them. He's talking to the hawk, the deer, the rabbits, the finch. You know, and he's just jabbering away like it's totally normal. We're like, we're just all blown away. And he starts telling the story. He goes, yeah, my second wife, she's a white woman. She used to laugh about Bigfoot, make fun of me. So I brought her right here to this very camp, and she stood right there on the creek. And I told her to stand there. I'd call it Bigfoot. He travels up the creek. So I said, all right. You know, it's like Boggy Creek. They always follow the creek. So he said he took his second wife out there, and she was standing there, and she was going, where is he? I don't see him. He goes, well, Bigfoot came up the creek, snuck up behind her, and then shoved her right in the water. I was like, what did she think? Like, what? Why didn't she like realize it was Bigfoot? You know, and he said, because when they travel like that, they travel like a big blue ball of light. And he said that like the very next after I had that sighting the night before.
That's kind of interesting, so, that he said that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's very strange. That's one of my woo things. I mean, I know a lot of people poo-poo the woo, but it's just my experience.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And I appreciate sharing it very much, Bobo. And you know, honestly, there was a long time where I would poo-poo the woo too. I mean, I was a really hard ass when it came to people who, you know, I used to call them flute players. They go out and play their flute, right? And I changed my opinion on that because you start to realize, one, you're kind of an arrogant dick with that attitude. And I'm talking about myself having that attitude. You know, for a guy that's seen a 900-pound monkey running around the woods, right, I sure am judgmental when it comes to something else someone else saw. So I kind of changed my tone on that. But what you find a very consistent, people are very consistent on what they saw. And it goes, I was going to ask you about some of the other cryptids and your opinions on them, you know, like this, Dogman or what people call the rake or what they used to call the ghoul out running around. I've had people run into these things and they're very, very consistent on what they saw. Like Dogman, for example, I used to argue with people all day long about, you must have seen a primate like a baboon or, you know, and after about the 100th person to tell you they ran into a Dogman where it was canine and they can't explain what they saw, you know, as far as what it was, but they can tell you it was very canine in the head and more manlike in the body, you kind of start to walk away and scratch your head and go, I don't know what people are seeing. I'm kind of at a loss. What's your opinion of like the Dogman or the rake or some of these other weird cryptids that people see?
I think people really are seeing them. I think people really are experiencing them, but I don't think they're in the same category as a Sasquatch. I think Sasquatch is in the fossil record. I think it's a, you know, normal evolved animal, whatever, primate. And then now you start talking about Dogman and these other things, and I think you're talking about totally paranormal. Like they're not just like a regular type of flesh and blood in this realm, 365 days, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. I don't think they're like in that physical form like that at all times. And I think people are genuinely, and I'm like you, dude, I told everyone, like, you just saw a Bigfoot and you didn't see a werewolf, like, you're nuts. But I heard it so many times. And I know when I was working on Mysterious Encounters a little bit, that was the show that Doug had before Monster Quest. Matt Moneymaker and Autumn Williams were the hosts on that show. I was doing a little behind the scenes work for them, and I didn't go to them there, but when they went to the Midwest, they were getting like 10, 15 to 1 in the upper Midwest, Dogman reports to Bigfoot reports. And we're just going like, guys, what the, these people are nuts, man. Like, why are they saying, they didn't call them Dogman, they called them werewolves. Then it's weird, like Dogman just all of a sudden, the nomenclature just switched and you don't even hear werewolf hardly anymore. So it's just Dogman, but no one was calling it Dogman. The first time I heard Dogman was only in Minnesota, the Minnesota Dogman. Then I started hearing about them from other places too, like all over. And I really got into the Dogman thing the last couple of years. And Cliff and I have an agent, and he does Meldrum and Lauren Coleman, all those, you know, Lyle Blackburn, all those guys. And he's, I mean, we all trust him. Like, we let him handle our money and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, we have faith in the guy. And he saw one point blank right in front of his car when he was 18 years old, walk right in the high beams 50 feet away. And, you know, he was the first guy that I knew real well that I trusted for sure what he said, who told me that. And that just sealed. At that point, I mean, I believed what they were saying, but when I heard it from him, I was just like, okay, I have no doubts anymore. This is what they are seeing, this other thing. And it could be, what do they call it? A trope, where it's kind of a group consciousness collective, like kind of generated. If it wasn't there before, just everyone believing in it will cause it to be seen, you know, that phenomena.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It could be that, like the Slender Man, you know, like how the Slender Man, it actually got these girls to kill another girl. You know, so it kind of became real in that sense. But yeah, I'm definitely fascinated by it. And then I think, well, then there's like, I think Sea Serpent Lake Monsters, that whole thing. I think that's just totally normal animal that just hasn't been caught yet. I think it's just some kind of giant eel, probably something like that. I think that's another cryptid that's just a standard animal with Mbele, whatever. God, I forget the African one, the creature that lives in the rivers.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
I think that's real just from talking about Adam Davies and John Kirk. I think those guys are on the ball and they're convinced it's real. So I think that's real. But when you start getting like rakes and Dogman and this and that, it's pretty mind blowing. I listened to I don't even think it was Dogman Encounters. Maybe it was, but one of the Dogman shows I was listening to, and they have this guy on. He's a great guest. He's like half Mexican. He speaks fluent Spanish. So he gets all the Mexican immigrants reports from down in Texas area and the ranchers, like white guys reports. So he's dialed into like both communities real deep. And he was telling the story about being at this abandoned church. And they were, when he was a kid, or he was interviewing, he talked to a guy that was there. This guy was like 12 years old. His sister and boyfriend that were 18 took him to this abandoned church, and they were in there like looking around. And all of a sudden he was looking out the window because he heard something and saw a dog man head pop up out of a well, like the old classic wishing well, you know, like the little stone wall around it.
Yeah.
And he saw, and then the dog man climb out and jump out and go into the brush. And two more came up in the next couple of minutes. Two more came out, you know, poked their heads out, looked around and jumped in the brush. And it, you know, they stalked him in the church, you know, for a couple of hours. So they finally got away. They ran to their car and drove away. But hearing that really freaked me out. Hearing, like, you know, seeing them come out of a well like that, like at a church.
Yeah, it's bizarre. You find them in, show up in weird areas. I tend to agree with you. I think that they are more of a spiritual side, but I think there's something weird about it that they can be very physical. I mean, I've had cops shoot at them and swear that they've hit them, and it seemed to have no effect on the dog man. But it is bizarre. I mean, they show up in graveyards. They show up in weird places you wouldn't think that they would. And one thing you'll hear a lot of people say is that they're evil, or they get a sense that what they're seeing is evil, which I wouldn't normally, I don't know that I'm 100% on board with your theory about Sasquatch, but that's okay. That's the beauty of this whole genre. But in the same breath, you don't hear a lot of witnesses say, I ran into Sasquatch and it was evil. You rarely, I mean, right. You do hear that from time to time, but it seems like with the dog man, 99% of the time, people are going to say what I saw was evil. There was something very different. It's a very different type of experience when they, not that you won't have fear with the Sasquatch, that's not what I'm saying, but people will just see a dog man and immediately they're terrified of it. You know, they want nothing to do with it. So there has to be some weird component to it being more on the spiritual side. I would imagine. I don't know.
Yeah. And then, you get in, well, I got some good friends on the Navajo reservation, and, a couple of times I've gotten together with these guys, and they're law enforcement, and they have the Navajo Rangers, who are kind of like forest rangers slash cops. Like,
oh yeah, they actually have more. They have the same authority as the FBI.
The Navajo Rangers. Yeah,
yeah.
So I was at lunch with about half dozen of those guys, and then a couple of Navajo homicide guys. And anyways, we were talking story, and they were telling me the one guy twice has gone out on calls where someone reported shooting a huge wolf kind of creature, like giant, and shot it and, you know, lad just took off out of the air, jumped in their truck and took off, whatever. And they said twice they've gone out there and found guys that were skinwalkers, naked guys. The guy said, I shot it three times right in the chest and once in the face, and they'll find like a guy shot with the wounds matching with the person reported shooting a giant wolf. You know, I don't know if that was a dog man or what, but they just said, yeah, they just figured it was a skinwalker that was in form, and then it got shot and the guy died. They never pressed charges. They never, you know, they just said they wouldn't even associate the person who told them the report with what happened. Like, they wouldn't even try to like prosecute the guy or whatever. They just took it as a fact that this guy was in the shape of a dog man or a giant wolf or whatever you want to call it. So I think that could account for some of it, maybe a little bit, like especially in that part of the country, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's really strange. I know we're kind of getting down to the end of the show. I actually had a really important question. Give me one second here. I had it written down. So Bobo, here's my very important question. Matt Moneymaker, Cliff, and Renee are all drowning, and you can only save one. Which one do you save?
That's a tough one.
If he's going to do it like that, do him all about it.
Shut up! I heard a response and he stepped on it.
I guess I got to think of a man, Cliff.
Yeah, you got to save Cliff, otherwise there's no podcast, right?
That's exactly it. You got it.
I'm just teasing you, man. If you were on Finding Bigfoot, what is the one thing that you loved the most about doing the show? And what is the one thing that you hated the most? The one thing that was the most pain in the ass for you doing Finding Bigfoot? And it could be anything, really.
The favorite part, I guess, well, you know, you're getting paid to travel first class, going to the most beautiful places around the world, was awesome. And then another big bonus for all of us we loved so much was our crew was just, we were like a family. They were hilarious. They were great, you know, fun people, solid people. So getting to be friends with the crew, like family with the crew on the road. And then also just meeting all these witnesses in great locations and learning a lot about, I learned a lot about Bigfoot behavior doing the show. And it was a good learning experience. You know, it was, I mean, and then the bad parts, I mean, being in a, you know, Cliff, Matt, Renee and I were in the same vehicle together for like 7-8 years, like every day, all day when we're, you know, we're shooting. So that'd get kind of old, you know, just being in the same car day after day. And then filming the show itself sucked. I mean, if we were just getting paid to go out and try to get Bigfoot footage, it would have been awesome. But the reality was they weren't paying us to find Bigfoot. They were paying us to sell ads on a television show. We were constantly at odds with the production over. We were actually trying to film a Bigfoot, and they were trying to film us film a Bigfoot. And especially when we had like crew that didn't believe in Bigfoots or even real, they thought it was just a waste of time. So they didn't see the benefit in doing anything we wanted to do. That was super aggravating. Cause if we would have went into it knowing that was the deal, it was one thing, but when they sold us the concept of the show, it was, oh, we'll stay out of the way. We're just going to follow you guys doing what you guys do.
Sergio, shut up.
So they, so that didn't happen. Like, it started off on the wrong foot, and that was the drawback of it. But we might actually be firing back up. They're in pretty serious negotiations about bringing us back on right now because everyone's jonesing for Bigfoot, you know, content. So yeah, we might be back soon enough. And this time we'd know going into it, this is the deal. You know, it's a cookie cutter format. You know, it's got its limitations, but we'll do what we can. We'll work in those constraints, trying to get the footage we're trying to get while they get the footage they need to get for their show. So I think it'd be a lot less of the bad parts, the worst parts about doing the show would be, wouldn't have the false expectations going up this time. So it'd be a lot more, I think, enjoyable.
Was there ever a moment where the cameras weren't rolling, where something bizarre happened? And
I had one walk up to me, a small one, it was smaller than me, walk up to me kind of in the dark playing chicken, trying to like keep walking. We were going to collide with each other. One night after filming in Ohio, that was a trip for sure. It was just a silhouette. I never saw like any details on it, but it just disappeared so fast. It was incredible. The speed that the thing took off and just literally disappeared was amazing. And then, what else? Oh, the base camp where the production crew was, they had more action than we did half the time. They'd be back in camp, you know, waiting for us to come back and getting our food ready, or they just kind of sat around and watched movies or whatever they did. And they'd get rocks thrown at them and this and that. But when we were filming in Kentucky, when we had the crying doll baby, we were doing that episode, they were all back at camp. And we heard it from 2 miles away, this huge, there was a 400 and something herd of cows in this pasture meadow area. And this giant Bigfoot, huge monster male one, walked in the middle of the cows and screamed and roared and stampeded them. And we heard it from 2 miles away, and two of the producers ran out in the field and they had thermal imagers, but they weren't recording. They were the old style that they had to have the DVR hook up to them. And we had those out in the field. So they just had the extra units back at the camp that didn't record, but two of the producers, you know, ran out to the edge of the camp and looked in the meadow and saw this thing just towering over the cows, you know, and you know how big dairy cattle are. I mean, they're big, fat cows, and this thing dwarfed them, just not just in height, but girth. Like they said, it had to judging by the cows, this thing had to weigh a ton or more. And it was walking real fast, and the cows were just in a, just total bedlam, just in total fear stampeding, you know, because you don't get dairy cattle stampeding all that much. These things are just stampeding, and they saw the thing and they flipped out and they called us back and we missed it. But so yeah, there's definitely stuff happened off camera for sure.
Did you guys ever see lights when you're out there doing your investigations?
In season one, Tyler Bounds was the solo camping guy that would go with us and film us for the first like 6-7 seasons. And him and I were in Minnesota, and it was the very first solo camp thing we did. So I told him, I said, man, I'm doing this. Like, I don't care what we do. Like, we're not. So we worked in the solo camping thing. And so I was out there, and we didn't have a car or anything. We were just stuck out in the woods. And we were walking back one night from getting water, and we were filming, you know, trying to see what I had the therm out. And we watched these two orbs come down, and it was above the power lines. People say, oh, it's just an electrical phenomena. And they came down the lines, then veered towards us, and then shot down into this berry thicket, like real thorny, some kind of blackberry, whatever. And when we walked by, it's like a low growl came out. And then when we were filming on the show with the full, Renee and I were in Oregon up at Chiloquin in Southeast Oregon with the Klamath tribe. The whole crew was with us, and we're walking. We thought it was headlights or headlamps coming down the mountain towards us, and they got within 70 feet of us. There's these two white orbs just kind of floating along, walking speed. And we watched them for quite a while. They did not show up on the cameras. They didn't show up on our little handheld. They didn't show up on the therms, and they didn't show up on the TV cameras either. Yeah, we had other weird, like electrical, like a brand new vehicle, the lead vehicle of our convoy going into that spot that night. The engine just died. And where the natives told us that kind of thing happens, like engines will die and that sort of stuff. And then we had other electrical mishaps and that was common too. You know, you talk about the paranormal stuff with Sasquatch stuff, the batteries, you know, the whole battery issue, like batteries draining real quick, that sort of stuff we encountered. Some of that could have just been bad old batteries and stuff, but I know when we were in Pennsylvania, we set up all these game cameras. They didn't go into it on the show, which I thought was kind of lame. We had 8 game cameras around this big, we dumped out like 5 gallons of pig blood and a bunch of butchered pig parts and all this stuff up on this rock where the focus of these Bigfoot reports were. We had we put out brand new batteries in all the cameras, set them up, came back, all 8 of them were dead and didn't get a single photo. And all the stuff was gone.
Yeah, don't you find that odd? I mean, you can pass off one camera failing. You can pass off 2 cameras failing. You can pass off 3, maybe 4. But once you start to get to all 8, it seems weird, doesn't it? I mean, don't you think like a weird, weird coincidence? Like the lights. The lights are very bizarre. And you'll find them on a lot of people's properties. When people have these creatures on their properties, the one question I'll ask all the time is, have you seen the lights? And I can tell you, I think I've only had one person tell me no in that whole, all the times I've talked to people, and I'm talking thousands of eyewitnesses, I think I've only had one person tell me no. It's weird. Same thing with the batteries. It's weird. It's a weird thing that goes on with these things. I think that's kind of why it's important to look at other genres too as well, Bobo, you know, like ghosts, UFOs. What you'll find is you'll start to find a lot of weird coincidences across the board with all of this stuff. I don't know what to make of it. It's hard to come up with an answer for people on certain things because I don't know. I don't know what the lights are. Yeah, it's weird that you're seeing them. And I've seen what you've seen, but what's very similar, where they're coming down a mountain and it looks like someone's holding a flashlight or like a lantern or something like that until you get within range and you realize that's not what that is. It's something else. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Just real quick, I was with Wally, the guy that funded the BFO for a long time, and Moneymaker and Cliff and Cindy Dosen. She's the woman in British Columbia that does the hair analysis, the microscopic study stuff.
Yeah.
So I went out with her. We heard some stuff out from camp. So her and I walked about a quarter mile out in the wood line, started getting some knocks around us, and heard like a whoop or two. And we're on Vancouver Island, probably about 2008, 2009, somewhere around there maybe. And we were out there, and we're like, Cliff, get out here, bring the audio recorder. Like, they're out here, come out here. So he's like, let me get my stuff together, I'll be right out. So we're watching him. We're like, God, what's he doing? Because we can see his headlamp around the camp, going around the fire, going. And then we saw it climb up on top of Wally's van. And we're like, what's Clifton? And we saw him go underneath, like to the like underneath the van. It looked like we're like, what's he getting? And then so then we see that, you know, the headlamps leave camp and it starts going down the trail. And then it took the wrong turn we had taken earlier. We end up in the middle of a thicket of thorns. And we said, I got on the radio. I said, Clifton, don't turn there. You're going the wrong way, man. And he goes, I'm still in camp. We're like, why? And we just watched. And it was this, you know, just this orb that was like a headlamp float down the trail. And it went off into the thicket and kind of sat there for a minute or two. And then it just went further in the thicket and disappeared.
Yeah, it's bizarre stuff, man. I always say you can run in more than just Bigfoot out there. But I really appreciate you coming on, Bobo, and sharing all of your experiences. It was a real pleasure talking to you.
That wasn't all of them.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to have you back for a part two. I love your guys' podcast. One thing, and for the audience, thanks. If you're a fan of Sasquatch Chronicles, definitely whatever podcast player you listen to, go check out Bigfoot and Beyond. It's a big orange icon with Cliff and Bobo. And one thing I really liked, I heard you guys say this the other day, because I usually give Bigfoot researchers a really hard time, just the arrogant ones, which is right. A large number of them. But one thing I always give them a hard time about is, you know, they always tend to act like they're saving the world and they're the Jane Goodalls, and they talk about their research like they're the Jane Goodalls. And I think it was you or Cliff, I heard you guys talking about it, and Cliff goes, it's basically camping and hiking, and we're kind of looking for Bigfoot at the same time. And I thought, you know what? These guys are good guys. I mean, because they're telling the truth. That's exactly what they're doing.
Totally.
They're, you know,
it's camping with a mission.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I enjoyed the podcast. It's nice to, even though you don't get to really get to know you guys, you feel like you get to know you guys after listening to the podcast. So I enjoy it. And I enjoyed having you on, Bobo. I'd love to have you back, man.
Oh, yeah. If you ever need someone, witness falls through and you need someone last minute, just call me up.
Thanks, Bobo. I really appreciate it. And thank you again for coming on, man.
Yeah, thank you, Wes. Yeah, you're the best, man. You've been an inspiration to us. We learned a lot from listening to your show. Like, basically, I told you earlier, the main thing I learned was shut up and let the witness talk.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, cool, man. Well, thanks for having me. If you ever need anything, let me know.
And that's it for tonight. Everyone, remember, if you've had an encounter, shoot me an email. My email address is wes@sasquatchchronicles.com. And if you get a chance, check out sasquatchchronicles.com. You can become a member and get additional shows. Until next time, everyone.
Sweeping across the country faster than the coronavirus, and wagering week is your antidote. I'm Tom Martin, and I'm a veteran sports analyst and respected sports handicapper who helped build ESPN's brand. I've been recognized and awarded by Pro Football Weekly and Gaming Today magazine as the honest handicapper. Let the other guys give you the same old boring sports talk with the same tired storylines. We'll give it to you straight here every Friday on Wagering Week. Don't gamble with other podcasts. Let Sports Garden Network's Wagering Week help your bottom line.